Friends, today we're going to talk about a country that has experienced arguably the greatest economic disaster in modern human history, Venezuela. As the country with the world's largest oil reserves, it held all the cards, yet in less than 10 years, its GDP plummeted by 80%. According to UN estimates, in 2024, 82% of the population live below the poverty line. Caracas has an entire mountain range covered in slums. The murder rate is among the highest in the world. In this country where gasoline is practically free, there are extreme shortages of basic necessities like toilet paper, food, and medicine. Even buying groceries requires showing your ID card, the last digit of which determines when you can shop, and supermarkets have very strict farm security. For over a decade, it has been trapped in a vicious cycle of hyperinflation. How absurd is the currency devaluation? If you stacked up 100 Bolivar bills from 20 years ago, you could physically fill the entire Bird's Nest Stadium in Beijing, not just once, but 40 times over. How much would all that money be worth today? Enough to buy a single hamburger at McDonald's, and you wouldn't even be able to get fries and a soda. Why? Hyperinflation, economic sanctions, corruption, institutional failure, price controls, Dutch disease, political instability, and other monstrous concepts have all afflicted this one country. So don't think we're talking about Venezuela today simply because it's a political hot topic. Let's look at Venezuela. It's a country on the northern coast of South America, with a land area of approximately 910,000 square kilometers, larger than the combined area of China's three northeastern provinces. It currently has a population of about 28 million. Originally, it was mainly inhabited by indigenous Amerindians. From the 16th century onwards, it was ruled by the Spanish for nearly 300 years, which is why Spanish is still spoken there today. It gained independence in 1830, making it one of the first South American countries to break free from Spanish rule. However, the key factor influencing its development was not independence or colonial status, but something else entirely. In 1914, Venezuela discovered its first commercial oil well, and in the next 21 years, it transformed from an insignificant country into the world's second largest oil producer, second only to the United States. We all say that oil is black gold, and this windfall of wealth made Marcos Perez Jimenez, the dictator of Venezuela at the time, the richest man in all of Latin America. As we discussed in our previous segment on oil, early global oil resources were monopolized by seven oil companies, mainly British and American, known as the Seven Sisters, forming a cartel. Venezuela's share was distributed among three of these sisters, Gulf Oil, Standard Oil, and Shell Oil. Initially, they had considerable power, as the technology for oil extraction and transportation was scarce, and Venezuela was just a small, insignificant country. So it only received a small portion of the oil profits. However, after World War II, these oil-producing countries began to realize something. Many companies were involved in the oil business, but the resource itself was only found in their countries. This resource was the most scarce and valuable. They were the landowners. So, Venezuela, along with other Middle Eastern oil-producing countries, negotiated with the Seven Sisters and signed a famous 50-50 profit-sharing agreement. Simply put, they said, "We'll let you extract oil in our country, and we'll split the profits equally." Later, they also joined four Middle Eastern countries to form OPEC. This immediately increased the Venezuelan government's revenue by an order of magnitude. This golden age had just begun. In just 5 years, government revenue increased sixfold. But the true golden age had not yet arrived. The previous wealth was just a prelude. In 1973, the Yom Kippur War broke out, also known as the Fourth Arab-Israeli War. Middle Eastern Arab countries collectively imposed an oil embargo on the West, plunging the world into an oil shortage. Oil prices quadrupled in a short time, from $3 per barrel to $12, marking the first oil crisis. A few years later, in 1979, the second oil crisis erupted, with oil prices soaring to $35 per barrel. This is 10 times what it was 10 years ago. Imagine, this caused global inflation, and the economy was affected. But for Venezuela, it was like a godsend, a blessing in disguise. With two consecutive oil crises, the biggest beneficiary was probably Venezuela. Look at it, it's an oil-exporting country, it has little connection to the Middle East, and it's so close to the United States. The Venezuelan government even completely nationalized its oil industry in 1976, establishing its own state-owned oil company, PDVSA. In this back and forth, if the previous oil prices were a gold mine for them, then this time it was a windfall. In just 10 years, Venezuela's GDP increased sixfold. The capital, Caracas, built the most modern highways in South America, along with skyscrapers and universities. State-owned enterprises flourished, and the number of employees grew to 300,000. Everywhere you looked, in elevators, public restrooms, office doorways, there was a service worker. That was a job position. Meanwhile, private enterprises shrank, but it didn't matter. Even if large companies didn't make money, they still received government subsidies. The Venezuelan currency, the Bolivar, became one of the strongest currencies in the world because of its very strong exchange rate. At that time, middle-class Venezuelans even went to Miami to shop on weekends. As long as oil prices remained high, the Venezuelan government had a continuous supply of resources. As long as oil prices remained high, every citizen could relax and enjoy a life of high income and high welfare. As long as oil prices remained high, there would be enough money to help the entire economy stand at the forefront of the world. However, good times don't last. In the 1980s, international oil prices began to plummet. Originally, the government hoped that this was just a short-term blip, so although government revenue began to decline, it did not cut back on the government's previously bloated spending, but instead chose to massively issue bonds, thinking that when oil prices recovered, they would immediately bounce back and be a great country again. But this was clearly too naive. It was just the beginning of a nightmare. To cope with high inflation, the United States announced interest rate hikes, and capital began to withdraw from the Latin American market. In 1982, Mexico was the first to succumb, declaring its inability to repay its foreign debt. The Latin American debt crisis officially erupted, and Venezuela was also severely affected. On February 18, 1983, the president announced the devaluation of the Bolivar, from $1 equaling 4.3 Bolivares to 7.5 Bolivares, and began to implement foreign exchange controls. Since Venezuela relied heavily on imports for its goods, this meant that the price of almost everything doubled in an instant. Who could endure that? This day is also known as Venezuela's Black Friday. Venezuela quickly fell into an economic crisis, and oil prices further collapsed in 1986, falling from $27 to less than $10. What was even more unexpected was that oil prices would fluctuate at this low level for nearly 20 years. Inflation in Venezuela began to rise, and the government tried price controls and foreign exchange controls, but to no avail. Corruption was too rampant. Many policies simply could not be effectively implemented. Moreover, many of these policies were counterproductive, further fueling inflation in Venezuela. We will analyze this in more detail when the situation becomes even more severe. The government found that various control policies were ineffective, and in 1989, a new president, Perez, was elected, who went to the opposite extreme, complete deregulation. He completely freed up foreign exchange, interest rates, and prices, allowing the market to fluctuate as it pleased. The government also stopped subsidies, and state-owned enterprises were privatized. This period is known as the Great Adjustment. Those who frequently watch our content should be familiar with this. In the 1990s, the concept of extreme market liberalization was extremely popular, mainly promoted by the United States. At that time, not only Latin America, but also Southeast Asia, and later Russia and Poland shock therapy, followed this style. They believed that the market could solve all problems on its own. Actually, from an economic theory perspective, the market-oriented and liberalization reforms themselves aren't the main problem. The issue is that these policies were too radical. Suddenly letting go of everything at once caused too much of an impact on the economy in a short period. Even more crucial is that this kind of free market competition has a prerequisite. The market needs a basic business environment and a basic rule of law. What was the situation in Venezuela? Market rules were vague, regulation was almost non-existent, many laws were merely symbolic, and then the government suddenly stopped intervening. Food price subsidies, energy subsidies, and minimum wage were all eliminated. This undoubtedly worsened the domestic economy, leading to multiple protests and riots. The Bolivar began to depreciate rapidly. We just mentioned that during the Black Friday of 1983, $1 was equivalent to 7.5 Bolivares, but by 1993, it had fallen to $1 for 100 Bolivares. In 1994, a major banking crisis occurred, with more than half of the banks, including the second largest bank, collapsing. Government corruption in the financial sector was completely exposed. President Perez, due to embezzling 250 million bolivares from the National Development Fund, became the first president to be removed from office by the Supreme Court. The Minister of Finance was also forced to resign, signaling the complete failure of the era of major adjustments. When the tide receded, everyone suddenly realized that almost everyone, this financial crisis, which many people might gloss over, actually, I believe, had a more direct impact on the Venezuelan economy than the problems we just discussed. It was like a heavy punch, hitting Venezuela square in the jaw, leaving it in shock. Speaking of this, I guess you can tell from our earlier discussion that Venezuelan politics is quite chaotic. Just look at how often the country's name has changed. When it gained independence in 1830, it was called the State of Venezuela, and later changed its name to the Republic of Venezuela. The Republic of Venezuela, after changing its name less than 10 years later, saw that the system in the United States to the north was quite good, so they adopted a similar system and changed its name to the United States of Venezuela. After World War II, they changed it back again to the Republic of Venezuela. After that, you can see that although their system has basically always been based on democratic elections, the elections are often rigged or severely manipulated. There are also many different power struggles within the government. Therefore, each president sits on a precarious throne, constantly balancing the interests of various groups, always wary of coups and impeachment, and trying to find ways to attract votes, while also thinking about personal gain. This inevitably leads to many problems, but I think a fundamental long-term problem is that its leadership cannot make long-term investments or formulate long-term plans. To give a simple example, don't the leaders of Venezuela know that oil prices will fluctuate and won't always rise? The simplest way to prevent this is to create a national fund, like Norway, and save money when oil revenues are high to buy gold, foreign bonds, and make long-term investments. Is that so difficult? Didn't the Venezuelan government think of this? Actually, they did try, but these presidents gradually realized that every time they tried to save money, it only became a piggy bank for the next president. The instability of their regime, coupled with severe corruption, made any long-term investment almost impossible. Note that I'm not only talking about investments with returns, but also institutional investments, such as investing in anti-corruption measures and establishing transparent and fair mechanisms. In Venezuela, the policies that presidents can implement to gain popularity are usually the most direct subsidies, which provide quick short-term results and public support. Actually, from this perspective, look at countries in the Middle East like Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE. They are monarchies with relatively centralized power. Although they have many problems stemming from their authoritarian rule, they can take a longer-term view and make many long-term investments. After all, this is not only an investment for the country, but also for their own future and their descendants. Look at their vision plans, right? They might even be making excessively long-term investments. In short, Venezuela's politics are quite chaotic. Let's go back to the period from 1980 to 1990. In a low oil price environment, Venezuela's GDP did not grow for 15 years. The economy was stagnant, with high inflation, and the public increasingly hoped for a major reform. Against this historical backdrop, in 1999, the most famous president in Venezuelan history, and one of the most controversial leaders, came to power, Hugo Chavez. With a military background, he led a very authoritarian government. He advocated what he called 21st century socialism, and later founded the United Socialist Party of Venezuela. He was very close to Cuba, and his relationship with Fidel Castro was very good. He even flew to Cuba several times to celebrate Castro's birthday. In fact, Chavez tried to overthrow the existing regime in 1992. And although he failed, he gained significant popular support. 7 years later, he participated in the election and advocated for large-scale reforms to change the status quo and eliminate corruption. Think about it, the people, who were utterly disappointed with the government's corruption, certainly hoped for a strong leader who could change the situation. So Chavez came to power forcefully and remained in power until his death from cancer in 2013. What did Chavez do first after coming to power? He changed the country's name from the Republic of Venezuela to the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. He said he wanted to carry out a thorough reform of the country, which he called the Bolivarian Revolution. You see, they seem to really like Bolivar, right? The country's name and the currency are both named after him. This Simón Bolívar, in fact, was a very great general who helped the whole of South America gain independence from Spanish rule in the 19th century. So he embodies a sense of independence. Chavez felt that the reason Venezuela was so chaotic before was mainly due to the encroachment of evil foreign capitalism. They exchanged our oil resources for wealth, trying to turn it into their own profits. Inflation. What kind of natural economic phenomenon is that? This is the evil forces of capitalism at work. So he drastically implemented a series of nationalization reforms. All key industries, such as banking, infrastructure, transportation, electricity, and telecommunications, were nationalized. At the same time, he increased taxes on foreign companies, which drove away most of the foreign investors. In 2001, he also passed a land law, allowing the state to requisition land and encouraging the establishment of small cooperatives, providing them with funding and technical support as an alternative model to the market economy. Chavez also successfully brought the previously independent central bank completely under government control through several legislative acts. From then on, the government could decide how much money to print, which actually laid the groundwork for the subsequent hyperinflation. And the most important nationalization that Chavez undertook, which I haven't mentioned yet, is oil. You might be wondering, didn't I just say that the oil industry was nationalized in 1976 and a national oil company was established? That's a good question. Actually, although it was theoretically state-owned before, because Venezuela was still very dependent on overseas technology and capital, Europe and the United States still had a lot of say, even being called a state within a state. So Chavez felt that the fate of our national oil company was still decided by Americans and Britons, and that they were taking so much money from us, which was simply humiliating. Therefore, in 2002, he placed some of his trusted people on the board of directors of the national oil company, intending to control it completely. At that time, he hosted a weekly TV program called Hello, Mr. President. On April 7th, during a program, he held a list of names and read out the names of the executives in the oil company who opposed him. He would blow a whistle and then announce, "So-and-so, you're fired." This incident escalated, even leading to a brief military coup attempt to overthrow Chavez, but he suppressed it. In late 2002, employees of Petróleos de Venezuela, PDVSA, went on a massive strike, virtually halting the country's oil production. Production plummeted from 3 million barrels per day to less than 300,000 barrels per day. This was equivalent to shutting down the country's economic engine. The strike resulted in a conservatively estimated $10 billion in economic losses for Venezuela, causing a 27% decline in GDP in the first quarter of 2003. However, these short-term economic losses were relatively minor compared to the long-term damage. Chavez responded very aggressively. "You're striking? You're not working? Fine, you don't need to come back anymore. You're all fired." Quote, he dismissed nearly 20,000 employees at once. You might not think that's a lot now, but for PDVSA at the time, it was almost half of their workforce. And consider this. It wasn't a typical layoff. Usually, layoffs target those who are easy to dismiss, but they specifically targeted those who participated in the strike. Regardless of their skills, key positions, or critical technical expertise, if they joined the strike, they were fired. This resulted in the dismissal of many highly skilled technical personnel. After this upheaval, Chavez successfully gained control of the national oil company, but at a very heavy price. Not only did external technical expertise leave, but he also fired a large portion of his own technical staff, setting back Venezuela's oil technology by more than a decade. Both management and technical capabilities suffered a severe decline. With aging equipment and loss of expertise, even today, more than 20 years later, their production capacity is less than half of its peak. Even with the oil there, they can't extract it efficiently. The equipment breaks down after only a short time, and they have to rest for half a day. Many American oil giants, including ExxonMobil, had their assets forcibly seized or were forced to accept new contracts in the period following this. It's important to understand that the vast refineries in the US and Mexico were designed to process Venezuelan heavy crude oil. This disruption wasn't just a short-term problem of reduced oil supply. It meant that these refineries, which had just received massive investments, would face a shortage of crude oil for decades to come. They had no choice but to find Canadian crude oil as a substitute. Therefore, as we analyzed before, a significant reason for the US targeting Venezuela is its oil. Not just because of its abundance, but because it matches US refining capabilities. The situation is starting to get complicated. Let me briefly explain. Some technical background to help you understand why oil-producing countries like Venezuela find it so difficult to escape the so-called resource curse. It's not simply a matter of having money leading to decline. Look, owning vast natural resources leads to exporting them in exchange for large amounts of US dollars. Then, they exchange these dollars for their local currency, the bolivar, causing the bolivar to appreciate continuously. When your currency appreciates, your domestically produced goods become more expensive for other countries, making them uncompetitive. At the same time, goods from other countries become cheaper for you, leading you to buy more from abroad. This severely weakens Venezuela's domestic agriculture and manufacturing industries, causing them to decline. Over time, from a national perspective, the economic model becomes one of solely exporting oil and buying everything else. Over 95% of its exports are oil, while over 80% of its industrial raw materials and over 60% of its food are imported. Its domestic manufacturing and agriculture decline, and the service sector becomes the main industry. It's like a rich kid who's spoiled because their parents gave them so much. They simply can't help but fall into decadence. This phenomenon has a specific term in economics called the Dutch disease, named after a similar phenomenon that occurred in the Netherlands in the 1960s. However, I think it should really be called the Venezuelan disease, Actually, this so-called disease wouldn't be a big problem if it could continue indefinitely. I could just keep selling oil, making money, and buying everything else. What's the key point here? This country's industrial capacity has deteriorated. It can't produce anything itself. It's like its economy has lost its immunity, and any slight disturbance could cause it to collapse. That's why the drop in oil prices in the 1980s had such a devastating impact on Venezuela's economy. You might think that a drop in oil prices would just mean less profit, not a collapse, right? Why did it happen? Because its non-oil sectors had lost their capacity and completely deteriorated. And what's the key to all of this? Look at the exchange rate. After Chavez's actions with the oil company, overseas investors definitely avoided this country. They all withdrew. What about the domestic population? They also lacked confidence in the domestic economy and currency. They would try to exchange their money for US dollars as soon as they got it. This led to a continuous decline in the Venezuelan bolivar exchange rate and a continuous rise in prices. Faced with these two classic economic difficulties, Chavez's response was incredibly simple and crude. First, the exchange rate was falling, right? He set an official exchange rate. Prices were rising, right? He set a price ceiling. This distorted supply and demand mechanism did, to some extent, maintain Venezuela's purchasing power, but at the cost of further deterioration of domestic productivity, further distortion of the economic structure, further growth of corruption in the black market, and more capital flight and shortages of goods. At this point, Venezuela was in a desperate situation, but things didn't collapse quickly. Instead, the lives of Venezuelans gradually improved. Why? Because the oil price rose again. In the early 2000s, the global economy experienced a surge, demand for oil increased dramatically, and oil prices increased sixfold in 7 years. Venezuela's gold mine was back. With the injection of abundant US dollars, the entire economy returned to the prosperous scene of the 1970s. Chavez, however, did not use this breathing space to establish a reserve fund, but instead spent heavily on subsidies, providing the public with almost free electricity, almost free water, almost free oil, very cheap food, and substantial housing subsidies. He also established thousands of free medical clinics for the poor. The price of gasoline in Venezuela was even cheaper than bottled water. $100 worth of gasoline was enough to drive around the world several times. Government departments grew increasingly bloated, and taxes became increasingly heavy. About a quarter of Venezuela's working population was employed in the government sector. Although the economic structure was unbalanced and basic necessities had to be imported, it didn't matter, because oil prices were continuously rising, and everyone had money in their pockets. People's lives improved under Chavez's leadership. The country's GDP quadrupled in just 10 years, and Venezuela was gradually eradicating poverty, with an urbanization rate reaching 90%, the highest in South America. You know, at this rate, it could soon become one of the wealthiest countries in the world again. At that time, to encourage people to take out loans, Chavez set a ceiling on interest rates. He encouraged people to borrow more, spend more, invest more, and save less. The maximum loan interest rate for credit cards was set at 29%. You might think that's very high, but you have to know that Venezuela's inflation rate at the time was 30% to 50%, meaning that the loan interest rate was lower than the inflation rate, and the real interest rate was always negative. After borrowing money, the amount you actually had to repay was getting smaller and smaller, while saving money became increasingly unprofitable. Naturally, everyone borrowed money and didn't save, creating a consumption frenzy in Venezuela. People used their salaries to buy things, cars, home appliances, luxury goods, and foreign travel. Many people bought cars not to drive them, but for financial investment. As long as they could get a car loan, they would buy a car without hesitation. The real estate bubble was even more extreme. This negative real interest rate made the gears of the entire economy accelerate wildly, and the speed of capital turnover became faster and faster. At that time, a very interesting consumption trend also emerged. Plastic surgery. Venezuela became one of the countries in the Americas with the highest rate of plastic surgery. Many women considered plastic surgery an essential step in adulthood. Families with the means would save money for their daughters' plastic surgery. Now, it has become a social norm that plastic surgery is a necessary path to better career opportunities and higher social status. Anyway, inflation is so rampant that you can't save money. But plastic surgery is for a lifetime. You should know that Venezuela is a global powerhouse in beauty pageants, arguably the strongest country in beauty pageants. Venezuela has won the most titles in the four major global beauty pageants and is also known as the Land of Beauty Queens. It has a very complete beauty pageant system. Not only is there the highest level Miss Venezuela competition, but every city, every community, and even every school has its own beauty pageant, forming a complete beauty pageant selection mechanism. Of course, this has also spurred related industries such as beauty pageant training, cosmetics, and plastic surgery. We were just talking about this casually. Now let's get back to the main point. In 2013, Chavez died of cancer. During his 14 years in power, oil prices first steadily climbed and then fluctuated at high levels. He used the wealth generated by oil to directly improve the lives of Venezuelans. However, some underlying economic problems, such as structural issues, corruption, and government inefficiency, continued to fester under the nourishment of the oil boom. His successor, Nicolas Maduro, also from the United Socialist Party, was not so lucky. Almost as soon as he took office, before he even settled in, oil prices began to plummet. Venezuela's good days were over. The events of the 1980s crisis basically repeated themselves, only this time more intensely. His economic structure and inefficient state-owned enterprises simply couldn't support domestic demand. Most essential goods had to be imported, bought from overseas. But with the oil price drop, he had no money and couldn't afford to buy them. In 5 years, Venezuela's import volume plummeted to 1/10 of its previous level, plunging into a severe shortage of goods. In 2015, due to the severe shortage of goods and government price controls preventing price increases, many food items, including toilet paper, were snatched up as soon as they hit the shelves. Many supermarkets had to be surrounded by iron fences, and armed security guards had to patrol the supermarkets to prevent excessive looting or riots. You'd think there were some treasures inside. Later, the queue in front of the supermarket was so long and chaotic that the government required people to get a number to buy things at the supermarket. They used the last digit of your ID card to determine which day you could go to the supermarket. For example, if your ID number ended in 0 or 1, you could go to the supermarket on Monday. If it ended in 2 or 3, you could go on Tuesday, and so on. To prevent people from using other people's IDs, they even installed fingerprint scanners at the supermarket entrance. During the peak of the 2017 goods shortage, many people were scavenging for food in the garbage. Out of humanitarian concerns, Colombia opened its border to provide some supplies and food to Venezuelans. Even with such severe shortages and soaring prices, one thing in Venezuela remained incredibly cheap, almost unbelievably so. Gasoline, not crude oil, but the gasoline for cars. Why? It's not because Venezuela has low oil production costs. As mentioned earlier, its equipment is outdated, and it lacks skilled personnel, making it almost incapable of refining gasoline. All the gasoline has to be imported. The reason it's so cheap is because the government continuously subsidizes it heavily, making it practically free. You could fill your tank for about a dollar, but there's no such thing as a free lunch. With gasoline practically free, everyone was scrambling to fill up, and the cost was transformed from money into waiting time queuing. So many people would spend their days waiting in line. I'm telling you, if you go to Venezuela, though I wouldn't recommend it, you'll see a long line of cars parked along the road all day, barely moving. This isn't a traffic jam. They're just queuing for gasoline. Even in the capital, Caracas, it's relatively good. The average wait is 5 to 6 hours. In many places, people wait for days, even a week. People basically sit in their cars queuing during the day, and when the gas station closes at night, they lock their cars and go home to sleep, then come back the next day to continue queuing. Of course, there are also market-based gas stations that charge according to international oil prices, and those don't have queues. But the vast majority of Venezuelans have become accustomed to this free gasoline, so they still choose to queue. Think about it. This isn't just a single gas station or a few cities. It's a nationwide phenomenon. What a waste of resources this is. People queue at supermarkets, they queue at gas stations, and it's even more troublesome for countless people across the country. Such heavy subsidies will also lead to smuggling problems. Many people will smuggle this cheap gasoline to neighboring Brazil or Venezuela to sell it. It is estimated that the value of this smuggling exceeds $10 billion every year, leading to a situation where gasoline is already in short supply, yet a large amount is still being smuggled abroad. Hearing this, you might be thinking, when oil prices were high before, your government had plenty of money, and you could subsidize or not subsidize as you pleased. That's understandable. But now that the economy is like this, and the government's finances are so strained, why are you still subsidizing anything? Just stop the subsidies. Quote, but no. The Maduro government doesn't want to, but it doesn't dare, because people have already gotten used to this almost free gasoline. Once you lift the subsidies, the oil price could increase by hundreds or even thousands of times, which would trigger strong dissatisfaction, anger, and protests from the public. The Maduro regime is already unstable, so it can only grit its teeth and continue the subsidies. Even more troublesome is that there's another layer of impact this time. In fact, starting in 2006, the US imposed some limited sanctions on certain individuals in Venezuela, including Chavez himself. And starting in 2014, the US said that the Venezuelan government has problems with human rights violations, undermining democracy, manipulating elections, etc., and that it would increase sanctions. This gradually evolved from targeting individuals to sanctions against the entire country. Especially after Trump came to power, He refused to recognize Maduro as president or the regime itself. The U.S., along with dozens of other countries, implemented very tough, comprehensive sanctions against Venezuela. The biggest impact was on the oil industry and financing transactions, freezing the assets of the state oil company, prohibiting the U.S. from buying its oil, and restricting all financing activities of the Venezuelan government and oil companies. In this way, the sanctions on the oil industry prevent the Venezuelan government from making money, and the restrictions on financing prevent it from borrowing money, essentially leaving it penniless. Meanwhile, on Venezuela's side, on the one hand, there were U.S. sanctions, and on the other hand, its oil production capacity severely declined after the general strike. As a result, Venezuela's oil production plummeted after 2015. The government's debt increased, and the deficit widened. In 2017, the government selectively defaulted on its foreign debt, and Maduro activated his contingency plan, a backup plan that economists most hoped to avoid. He started printing money. We've discussed this before. Zimbabwe's hyperinflation was due to the rapid devaluation of its currency, the rapid addition of zeros, forcing them to continuously introduce new currencies. Venezuela is no different. Its previous currency was called the Bolivar. Because of severe devaluation, in 2008, they removed three zeros and introduced a new currency called the Strong Bolivar, where one strong bolivar equaled 1,000 bolivares. Initially, one U.S. dollar equaled 2.15 strong bolivares. Later, it gradually depreciated further, reaching one U.S. dollar to 10 strong bolivares. You might think this devaluation is still acceptable, but let me tell you, this is only the official exchange rate. The black market exchange rate had already reached one U.S. dollar to 10,000 strong bolivares. Because the black market was so prevalent, the official exchange rate also had to depreciate accordingly, falling to one U.S. dollar to 4 million strong bolivares by August 2018. What could they do? They removed five zeros again and introduced a new currency unit called the Sovereign Bolivar. One Sovereign Bolivar equals 100,000. By 2019, hyperinflation had exceeded 300,000%, meaning that 30,000 units of currency today would be equivalent to one unit next year. So, in 2020, they introduced a new currency called the Digital Bolivar, removing six zeros from the Sovereign Bolivar. Doesn't that sound confusing? The current exchange rate is approximately one U.S. dollar to 325 Digital Bolivares. If we use the original Bolivar from 2000, we would have to add 14 zeros after 325, resulting in 325 million bolivares. Actually, you don't need any knowledge of economics to imagine that when prices rise to this extent, the economy is basically completely paralyzed. Everyone is desperate to get rid of their money as quickly as possible. They don't care what's expensive or cheap anymore. If you see toilet paper, you buy it. You hoard whatever you can. Forget about investment and production. Once a country falls into this vortex of hyperinflation, it's very difficult to get out. However, look at Venezuela's inflation. It miraculously decreased in 2020. Why? Well, I'll tell you, it's not miraculous at all. It's because Venezuelans completely abandoned their own currency. They completely disregarded the Bolivar, their national currency. Even if you give them a super-duper Bolivar, the entire country started using US dollars for transactions on a large scale. They dollarized the economy. Now, if you go into restaurants, street stalls, or supermarkets, most prices are listed in US dollars. The Bolivar currency is barely circulating. And you should know that the US dollar isn't even the official currency in Venezuela, so US dollar bills are very rare. You can't withdraw them from ATMs, especially small denominations. This leads to a rather amusing phenomenon. For example, if you eat risotto at a restaurant and it costs $13, don't expect the restaurant to give you the change for the $2. You just order something else to make it $15 and everyone is happy. Therefore, American dollar payment software like Zelle and PayPal are very common in Venezuela. This means that a large number of transactions in Venezuela are actually completed between banks in the United States. Venezuelan banks and the government are completely helpless in this situation. In the past 10 years, more than 8 million people have fled Venezuela, which is more than a quarter of its population. They all left in just a few years, and this includes many talented people, wealthy individuals, and students. Everyone who could leave. The problems with the corrupt economic structure weren't entirely unsolvable, but now that the people are gone, this is an irreversible loss. The long-term impact on Venezuela is devastating. Many people earn less than $10 a month, less than $10 a month, which is simply not enough to make ends meet. Most of them rely on relatives abroad to survive. Many of their ancestors immigrated to Venezuela in the 1950s and 60s, full of hope, only to experience so much upheaval and hardship over the years. Now their children are forced to flee the country. This wave of immigration has led to hundreds of thousands of Venezuelan immigrants being accepted by South American countries like Colombia, Brazil, and Argentina in the past 2 years, which has indeed taken many people's jobs in the short term, causing significant instability throughout South America. Therefore, this wave of immigration can be considered one of the major crises facing South America recently. In 2020, the country's GDP fell to only 15% of what it was 10 years ago, even lower than the 1980 level. However, after listening to our analysis, you can probably see that the high GDP more than a decade ago didn't mean the economy was booming, and the recent economic collapse isn't just a problem of the last decade, nor is it just the fault of the Maduro and Chavez governments, but rather a culmination of deep-seated problems accumulated over a century. In fact, Venezuela's urban infrastructure isn't like many African countries that are simply poor. You can tell it used to be wealthy. But in the last 10 years, the government has indeed run out of money, and its management of public order and welfare has become largely neglectful. Overall security is very poor. Therefore, for several years now, many countries have officially advised their citizens against traveling to Venezuela because it's very dangerous. There's an area in Caracas called Petare, where the walls are painted in vibrant colors, quite beautiful, but it's actually one of the largest slums in Latin America, home to over 2 million people. The houses on the hillsides are densely packed together, without even stable water and electricity supplies or sewage systems. During the day, it seems peaceful because people are either sleeping or working in the city, but at night, it becomes a haven for gangs and one of the regions with the highest crime and murder rates in the world. Even the boldest social media influencers need to hire experienced guides and travel in groups, staying inside their vehicles, just to dare visit this place. And even after leaving this slum, the security situation in the capital, Caracas, isn't much better. If you accidentally wander around in the wrong place for a couple of turns, your UPS package and all your money will be gone. If you drive in the capital, you'll find that at night, traffic lights are basically just decorations. Nobody pays attention to them. Everyone just runs the red lights. Why? It's not because all Venezuelans are thugs who want to break the law, but mainly because the security is so bad. A couple of years ago, there were incidents of people being robbed and even shot while waiting at red lights, which is why people don't dare linger and just speed through red lights. The traffic police have completely given up on enforcing traffic laws. The entire city, the entire country, has basically descended into complete traffic anarchy, including the subway system. At first glance, the subway looks much better than New York's subway system. It was built in the early 2000s when the country was very wealthy. But now, the government lacks the ability and resources to operate the subway. The entire Caracas subway system is free. The ticket machines and turnstiles are just for show, and the escalators are broken. The subway trains are still running, but the frequency isn't high. Since it's free anyway, people just rely on their own strength to squeeze onto the trains. There's no air conditioning inside. Venezuela relies on hydroelectric power plants built over half a century ago to meet the country's electricity needs. But due to a lack of skilled personnel, poor maintenance, and a shortage of alternative energy sources, power outages occur almost every other day. Especially in 2019, there was a nationwide supermassive power outage that lasted for over a week, resulting in at least 43 deaths. Subsequent investigations revealed that over $80 billion of the $100 billion invested by Congress in the power system was embezzled, and over 14 thermal power plants were completely non-functional. You can imagine the situation here, and I've made so many videos analyzing the country's economy. I've found that you can't just look at research reports and economic data. If we only focus on economic analysis, we might have a skewed understanding of people's lives in that country. Actually, you can watch videos and vlogs made by people living there. I've watched many, listening to people describe their lives, and I have a profound feeling that their lives, in terms of happiness index and their expressed mood, may not be as dire as the economic data suggests. All the economic problems we've discussed do exist. Venezuela's economy is indeed a mess. But South Americans are incredibly optimistic, very easygoing, and very good at enjoying life. They complain and criticize about wages, prices, and the government, but they laugh heartily at the drop of a hat, dance when they hear music, and still watch baseball on weekends. Caracas is indeed very chaotic, with high crime rates, but it's not like everyone is so tense they don't dare go out. People still go about their business, working, going to school, etc. If you see where a gang might be doing business, you just take a detour. If you see a red light, you stop. In recent years, with the full dollarization of Venezuela, inflation has basically disappeared. The government's finances are extremely strained, forcing them to abandon the previous welfare state policies. While the shelves are once again filled with goods in supermarkets, market-based pricing has led to Venezuelan prices being even higher than in Miami across the water. People's real wages are less than 50 years ago. Gangs demand protection money, and police often extort bribes. The entire country has fallen into a state of jungle law, a semi-anarchic state. After Maduro is gone, the US will likely be more interested in Venezuela's oil and politics, and unlikely to expend much effort on reforming its economic structure and social order. Overall, the uncertainty in its economic development is extremely high. It has essentially entered a shock therapy phase. An economy with abundant resources and sufficient income failed to utilize those resources effectively, instead fostering government corruption and allowing domestic productivity to decline, exacerbating economic imbalances. At the same time, policies such as government price controls, foreign exchange controls, and interest rate controls can lead to this situation. It's like an immature child who makes mistakes and gets confused. Under normal circumstances, harsh reality would immediately teach him a lesson. This is an automatic correction mechanism. However, if he suddenly possesses astronomical wealth, this correction mechanism may fail. Small economic imbalances, minor corruption, and slight price distortions, in an environment of continuous wealth influx, fail to receive timely feedback, causing him to deviate further and further from the right path. By the time he reaches the brink of collapse, if oil prices plummet, the backlash will lead to a vicious cycle, making it difficult for him to recover. Therefore, sometimes having too much money, and spending it incorrectly, can be more deadly than having no money at all. As Venezuela's former Minister of Energy, also known as the OPEC payment negotiator, said, "Oil will bring us destruction. is the excrement of the devil. This may be true for Venezuela,